passion. This is all in for the love of the game. This is Love Set Match.
I mean, Andre Agassi had this goal. You don't have to be better than everyone else in the draw when you go out on the court. Like, you have to be better than someone that's across the net.
I think you got to stay active in a sport sense, you know, go out there, do some sports. I think it always makes you feel better, maybe more tired in the very moment, but actually the rest of the day feels better. And then I think giving back as well, you know, making other people happy is going to give you a good feeling too.
Hello and welcome to Tennis Pal Chronicles, the podcast to feed your passion for all things tennis. I am your host, Philip Kim, also known as Coach PK, the tennis pro for the Langham Huntington Hotel in sunny Southern California. And it's a nice warm weekend. And I'm also the executive director of our nonprofit Love Set Match. Tennis Pal Chronicles is sponsored by Tennis Pal, the best app to find people to play with. Visit tennispal.com to download the app today. Gosh, we have an insightful and colorful interview for you today. Thanks to my good friend Fo, I was able to meet Clarence Alley Thompson IV. Clay, as he's better known, is an American former professional tennis player and current entrepreneur. He was born here in SoCal in Venice, California, and attended 6th through 12th grade at Crossroads School for the Arts and Sciences in Santa Monica. He was a top-ranked national junior and ended his high school career as the number 3 recruit in the country. Clay Thompson decided to play for Billy Martin at UCLA. During his tenure at UCLA, he earned a BFA in creative writing with a minor in film and TV. And during the entirety of his 2014 senior season, he was ranked the number 1 NCAA tennis player. Thompson holds a 119-35 record, one of the highest number of wins for a UCLA player in the school's history. Clay went on to turn pro and went viral with perhaps one of the funniest tennis videos you've ever seen. You have to check it out. In this interview, Clay shares his rise through the juniors, his supportive parent relationship, his insights for being a professional on tour, coaching WTA rising star Nicole Gibbs, and his new app venture for tennis players called Improve. So let's check in with Clay Thompson. Clay Thompson, thank you so much for joining me here on Tennis Pal Chronicles. It is such a pleasure to meet you in person. I feel like I kind of know you because we have mutual friends, and I was actually invited to the clinic that you did in Claremont, but I didn't get to make it out for that day. But I saw the video. I watched it. I watched you serving bombs, and no one could return them. That was a lot of fun.
It was a really interesting day, and I'm definitely going to do it again. And, you know, Fo has such a great collection of just kind of open-minded people that are playing tennis and want to get better, and I really kind of appreciate that. And I definitely appreciate sort of the community that he's brought together in that area, you know, around tennis. And that's the coolest thing for me is how tennis brings people together, you know, how it brings out their personalities in the form of competitiveness and even, you know, the way that they approach the game and they approach getting better. And it was a really cool experience to come out there and see that group. The interesting part is I still stay in great shape. I play tennis 4 or 5 times a week. I, you know, work out with a trainer, do PT, all that stuff. And that day, wow, Somehow I woke up with a very weird tweak in my foot. And so I'm limping up to the court. I'm like, no, we're not going to cancel this. There's no way. But I get there and I'm like, man, I really like can barely walk. And so I'm like coming up to the court and people are like, oh, Clay's here. Like, let's say hi to him. And they just see this 6'6" figure limping along, just laboring. And I'm like,
oh my gosh,
I can play.
Oh my God.
So it was quite an experience for sure. But we definitely want to do it again. And everyone that was there, you know, Fo does a great job leading it. Matt Lynn came out, who I'm good friends with from UCLA. And there were a couple other, you know, just kind of people there that really were open to getting better and playing tennis. And, you know, I loved it. So definitely going to do it again.
Yeah. So, So Matt is a good family friend. He literally lives down the street from us and, you know, is part of our Monterey Park community. We all watched him grow up here on the courts. You know, for over 20 years, he started playing at like, I think, five or something. Yep. And his dad coached him every day. And so we saw him just evolve into, you know, a super solid player. And it was really fun to cheer for him. And he was like number one in the whole San Gabriel Valley at that time. You know, it was just amazing.
Yeah, he's a great, he's a great person, and I actually have a picture of
a great guy.
Me and him my freshman year at UCLA. So I guess I think he was potentially still in high school. Still, do you know how old he is? Is he a year younger than me?
I don't. Yeah, know
I think he might have still been in high school. Maybe he's the same year as me, but he was pretty young, and we have a great picture together. And you know, of all of our interactions over the years, we kind of keep referencing that photo as like that's kind of where our friendship began. And he's just a great guy all around.
Absolutely, yeah. And his whole family is just amazing. And speaking of, you know, being a child and playing tennis, I'd love to start there and just kind of hear a little bit about, you know, your journey. This podcast is really for the people who have a passion for tennis. Yep. So they, most I think are recreational players, but all across the board, people who understand that tennis creates this passion inside your life that motivates you in a way that like no other sport. And really there's a sense of community that comes around tennis as well. And I'd love to hear your story. What motivated you as a child to choose tennis rather than, you're obviously tall, you could have played basketball, volleyball. I'm sure you're an incredible athlete. You could play a lot of different sports.
Yeah. So I got into it because my dad was a recreational player and I was kind of brought up in the, you know, public park community type of things. I'm sure you have, you know, plenty of experiences at public parks where all, you know, the players come there, you know, however many times a week, they all know each other. They all compete to kind of see who's the best and they all have some type of ego related to it. And it's a complete cast of characters. I mean, it's almost like a soap opera in a way. I mean, I remember there was, you know, one of the best players down there was a Spanish guy who was like 5'2", but he would just run you into the ground and he was so physical and, you know, love that.
That's
and then
great.
There was, you know, on the other side, there was the 6'4" ex-basketball player who was just a great athlete and had been playing tennis for 20, 30 years. And so I kind of grew up, you know, playing at that public park and, you know, one of the coaches there was my original coach who kind of taught me that, you know, huge take back, open stance forehand. And that was kind of, you know, what spurred my initial interest in the game. And then that's kind of where the legend began, so to speak.
Do you want to give a shout out to that park? Because I love the
it's,
idea.
It's Ocean View park. It's the best public courts in West LA, Ocean View Park, right on Ocean and Nielsen Way. And it's, and so the street, you know, the street ocean is here. There's the beach right there. And then the basketball courts and tennis courts. So it's real oceanside playing.
That's incredible.
It's awesome. Yeah.
But, you know, you as a child, like you're with your dad. A lot of kids don't want to do the sport that their dad plays, right? So what was it inside you that said, hey, I'm going to choose to do this?
Well, my dad, it's not like my dad was like a wildly successful player. He was just kind of a, you know, I would say he was a good 5'0", 5'5" recreational player who, you know, tried to play some tournaments when he could. He kind of fell in love with the game in Hilton Head Island off the coast of South Carolina. That's where he kind of learned and he lived there for a couple of years. And then he came back to LA and he just kind of kept it going. So I didn't really have the pressure of like, oh, my dad is this great player and I have to kind of live up to that sort of thing. It was a little bit more like he did it for fun and this was something that he was sharing with me as kind of a, you know, a hobby and a way to bond. And I think we both really appreciated that. And it sort of, I think that kind of introduction to tennis shaped my view on it, which was more like you play tennis with your friends, your family, you know, other people around the world that you want to compete against, but it is kind of very much a communal sport. And I think because I stayed in LA, I went to school, I, you know, stayed close to my friends and family, I kind of had the support of that LA community. I think a lot of players who are at my level kind of come up with their community and then they say, okay, now I'm really good and I want to go train with the USTA in Florida, or I want to go to this academy in, you know, wherever
Spain.
It is. And, and, you know, to some extent you need to kind of do that because it's tough to find good practice for yourself and whatever. But on the other side of the coin, that community is really who creates you as a player. I mean, those are the people that will kind of follow your career. Those are your fans. Those are people that could help out with, you know, sponsorships down the road, because we all know how financially difficult tennis is. So, I mean, these are really kind of your, you know, your fan base and like the people that support you, and sort of to go away from them, I always thought was kind of a weird move. And I just saw a lot of my colleagues do that. And I was like, I don't want to do that. You know, I want to stay close to the people that have supported me my whole life. And, you know, obviously I will go around and play tournaments, but at the end of the day, I kind of want to have my base be surrounded by people that support me.
That's great. You had mentioned Venice and playing on the beach. Were you a surfer at all? Did you get into that?
I may look the part, but I never got into surfing.
You definitely have the highlighted hair and the surfer tan.
I mean, I even got the, I guess you can't see. Oh, yeah, you can see the surfboard in the frame back there. I've never used that thing. It just holds all my tennis credentials over the years.
That's awesome. So great. And what was it like being a tennis player in Venice, California? I mean, there wasn't a lot of pro tennis immediately in your area.
No, there wasn't. But there's also the Santa Monica Open was one of the most famous open tournaments in the country at one point. All the pros would come back from Wimbledon. We're talking, you know, 70s. We're talking amateur tennis in the like 70s and potentially a little bit in the 80s. But, you know, the pros would come back from Wimbledon and then they would come to Santa Monica and they would play the Santa Monica Open. And it was like, it was, I mean, the names that were in that tournament were incredible. And so there is a history, and obviously, you know, West LA, LA in general is a desirable location for people to come. So there definitely is a history there, but it's not as strong, nearly as strong as it used to be. And I think it's not as strong as kind of it would seem. I mean, a lot of the, you know, the high schools around here, none of the high schools are really that competitive except for Harvard Westlake. There's really no high-performance tennis academies. Maybe Pacific Palisades Tennis Center, which is kind of where I trained, they do a pretty good job. And then, you know, Mountain Gate a little bit. But there's not really great academies. There's not really great clubs. There's not really great player development facilities in West LA, despite kind of all that tennis history that I just kind of mentioned.
Yeah. Well, hopefully that's going to change. They are talking a little bit about a new El Segundo Center that the USTA is funding with the Kimmelman family, right? So something may or may not happen. But
sucking in jet fumes, baby. Right next to the airport. Perfect place to put a high-performance tennis center. Yeah, I love that idea.
And I think as iconic as your story is, your name is even more iconic. Clarence Alley.
Clarence Alley Thompson right? IV. C-A-T.
IV. Yeah. So you've got to tell us about that name. That's so fun.
Yeah. So my dad's side of the family has kind of been, they were originally English immigrants, I guess, or they came over, you know, whatever you use for that word. And they came over like right at the beginning of the U.S., really. I mean, they were kind of in the Civil War era. And so though I've kind of, you know, had that heritage on my dad's side of the family. And Clarence Alley Thompson is a name that was pretty respected in the military. I think Clarence Alley Thompson I, I believe, was a lieutenant colonel in the Army. And then my whole dad's side of the family was kind of in the armed forces in one degree or another until my dad basically was the first one that didn't. His older brother, unfortunately, got killed in Vietnam. And so he kind of started the, oh, I don't want to go into the armed services. And, you know, that obviously reflected on me as well. But the whole other side of my dad's side of the family, or that whole side, is all kind of armed forces and military. So,
oh, that's so interesting to learn. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. So what did your father and mother decide to do, and how were they as, you know, tennis parents?
So again, because of that kind of sort of traumatic experience that I just mentioned for my dad, he sort of kind of gravitated towards the counterculture movement in a way that was like, you know, war is bad, which was, you know, he had seen my grandfather, obviously Clarence Alley Thompson II, kind of, he was well-respected military man, and he kind of flamed out in the end of his life. He had a bunch of just health issues, and I mean, he served many tours. So it's just, you know, tough being a veteran in that circumstance, and also as a father, and then for his brother to be, you know, to meet that unfortunate happening. I think he was kind of like, wow, like war has really kind of scarred me and my family in a lot of ways. And so he kind of, you know, went against that, and he got very into, you know, therapy. He was a psychotherapist. He started he helped start a herbal company called Herb Farm, which is, you know, echinacea, St. John's wort, all different types of, over-the-counter alternatives for medicine. And, you know, he was just a really, and this kind of, I think, bled its way into me, was he was very much into, you know, self-improvement. And for him, it was self-improvement of a traumatic childhood because of, you know, the events that I just mentioned. And I think, so for him, it was kind of healing through the pain that the military had potentially caused his family. And so for me, you know, because I didn't really have that trauma to heal necessarily, I think he was able to kind of mold me a little bit into, okay, like, you don't have to start with this trauma, so you're going to kind of start with the good stuff and like how I healed myself. And those kind of programs, I feel like, and that kind of just mentorship really kind of developed me into the player that I feel like I ended up becoming. And I think that was kind of one of my strong suits, was the fact that I was able to have a cool head, even though I, you know, was kind of a exciting and energetic player. It was all kind of planned, right? it was all like as a character. It was all for the passion of the game. It wasn't ever really me like losing my cool and like acting like a complete madman that I wasn't trying to be. You know, all my kind of energy and vigor that I had on the court, that was calculated to kind of help me perform at my best. And again, that was the way that I liked to play tennis, and it brought me joy.
Yeah, that's so fun that you mentioned that. I'm sure it comes up a lot, the whole viral Klay Thompson videos that are out there.
Yeah, I mean, that one video is definitely a kind of one-off. I think that was the only tournament I ever really acted that extreme. But I mean, that's, hey, it came into a viral video, and that's exactly what I wanted to happen.
It really worked, man. Put your name out there for sure. And that it's so much fun. And talk about passion while you're playing. That's just incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like I've always had a passion for the game. I've always loved it. And the way that I kind of was brought up, I think instead of, you know, having to go away from your friends, instead of having that traumatic experience of being like, you have to train 8 hours a day and your livelihood depends on this, for me, it was a little bit more like, this is something I really enjoy doing. And I really enjoy testing my mental and physical fortitude against other international competition. And so that idea to me, and I think that is kind of the essence of tennis, was really, really appealing. And I do feel like that kind of set me apart from some competitors that were just so focused on, you know, the result.
Yeah. And you were really one of the the most successful teens in your time as a junior. What allowed you to win so much, and how would you explain that? Do you consider it something that's just a part of who you are? Do you feel like it's something that you learned?
Again, I would attribute it to my almost curiosity in a way. So when I would play a tournament, I wouldn't feel like, oh, I'm in the Easter Bowl, and if I play this person in the first round who's good, I'm like, oh man, I'm so like so nervous. I'm so like, I don't want to lose to this guy. I don't want to, my, you know, UTR is the thing now for us. It was tennis recruiting. So all my friends were like, oh, if I lose to this guy in the first round, my tennis recruiting goes from a 9 to an 11. And then it's blah, 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 blah. And they just kind of like snowball down this, like, what happens if? For me, my mentality was just like, oh, I get to go to Easter Bowl in Palm Springs. Awesome. I get to play someone who maybe I've played before, maybe I haven't. And it's a test for me to see if I'm better than them. Awesome. And then if you find yourself, and I did find myself in the kind of the final rounds there multiple times, it's like, there's people watching, my friends and family are here, it's great weather, like, I'm just playing tennis against, you know, Jack Sock, I'm playing tennis against Warren Hardy, like, someone else that's, like, a really good player, and to me, I think that was really fun, and to a lot of my other competitors, it was like, oh, like, I really gotta win this, or my dad's not gonna love me. Like, it's just like, there's like such weird pressures that kind of that come out in those top tier players that make them so competitive. And for me, I feel like that, you know, I had really supportive parents, and I feel like that wasn't really the case. It was kind of just more like, let's go out there and see who's better.
Yeah. Can you explain a little bit about what, how your parents supported you? Like what, in what way did they help you to deal with wins and losses? Because I feel like this is an issue for parenting in general in tennis and just the idea of dealing with losses. I love the quote that you have out there. I'll just read it. The best thing that tennis in general teaches you is how to lose every single day and still get up and strive to get better the next day.
Yep.
I mean, that is powerful, powerful stuff. And yet, it sounds easy. It sounds great on an Instagram post, but to actually do it is so hard.
Yeah. And, you know, that I, that quote was in the context of kind of doing what I'm doing now. And, you know, it's life knocks you down left and right. I mean, there's no way it doesn't. I've talked to so many successful people that are just like, you know, I've been knocked down way more times than I've got, than I've, you know, than I've succeeded, but I just keep getting up and keep getting back to it. And I think the trend there is the fact that you got to love what you do. I mean, if you get, if you keep getting knocked down and you keep getting, you know, it thrown back in your face and you're like, man, I have to wake up and do this thing that I hate again, and I'm going to get knocked down again. And it's just like so tough. And so I think that the way that my parents supported me was they put me into a good community. So I had friends to play with. Maybe they weren't as good as me, but I had plenty of people to play with that I liked playing with. And I was in, you know, surrounded by coaches that I liked being with, who I thought saw the game on a similar level as me, not someone that was trying to mold me into a player I didn't want to be. And they just kind of provided an atmosphere to be like, hey, lose, you know, the Stan Wawrinka quote, lose, fail better, you know, fail once, fail better. Like, and that sort of environment was really uplifting to me in the sense, like, I never felt pressure. Like, my dad was never like, oh, if you don't get this scholarship, you know, your life is over. Like, it wasn't like that. It was just like, you have the opportunity, if you keep winning, to get a scholarship to play at a program like UCLA. I mean, and just the way that you phrase that, instead of, if you don't win, you're not going to get a scholarship, to, if you win, you get this chance to, that everyone in the world almost would dream of having, and you are lucky enough to have that chance. So go out there and see if you can get it.
Yeah. Wow. That's great. So it's really that positive mentality that maybe they surrounded you with that allowed you to feel good about yourself, win or lose.
Yeah, I would say that's correct. And I think it's also the people that, that you're surrounded with. And again, as I mentioned, I felt like I always had friends to play. I always had good players to play against. And a lot of the juniors, especially that I talk to now, are like, oh, I have this friend that I could play against, but he's not good enough. I need to go, you know, here to train with this person who's my level. It's, I mean, I was playing with, you know, whatever. I was top 10 in my recruiting class, whatever I was. And the people that I would practice with were like 200, 300 in their recruiting class. Like, it didn't make any difference to me. Like, I could still get what I needed out of practice. And then you would go to tournaments and play those. And I think that's one of my biggest complaints with juniors nowadays is they're like, oh, I can't play with that guy. He's 2 UTR points lower than me. It's like, why not? just beat him.
Yeah, that's great. I love that idea that you should just make the most out of every opportunity that's given you, and especially if it's a supportive community, right? Enjoy being in that supportive community.
Yeah, I think, and just to kind of put a pin on that, I think this is one of my philosophies now, is I think sports science and competition has gotten to a place where it's no longer make the athlete, break the athlete down, work them until they're ragged, and just see if they kind of break through that. I think now the secret to success is putting the athlete in a community that uplifts them and makes them feel every single day like they are it, for lack of a better word. I mean, you have to make the athlete feel like they're the man, the woman, whatever. I mean, the king or the queen, the champion, whatever it is. You need to make them feel like that, I think. And I think that the most successful athletes are the ones that are put in that environment.
That's great. Wow. So let's talk about UCLA, which was incredibly pivotal for you. What was it like to get in? I mean, just to get that yes for UCLA, that's just huge.
Yeah. it was amazing. I didn't realize it at the time, because at the time you're a kid, you're winning in tennis, you know, everything's going well. You're like, oh yeah, I get to choose my crop of any of the schools that I want to go to. I mean, it's pretty unbelievable. So at the time, I think I was like, oh, this is cool. But now looking back at it, and especially during my time there, I remember just walking around the halls and being like, how did I get here? Like, what? I mean, there are so many smart and successful and just cool people that ended up here, or that studied here. Right. And I am among them now. It was definitely quite an experience.
I've got to ask, did you consider USC at all? Because they had an amazing tennis team.
They do have an amazing tennis team. Kind of a funny story. I won't go into it entirely because I don't know exactly, you know, what. I don't want to give away everything. But basically, I had a little bit of a disagreement with Peter Smith on something. And he kind of said, okay, I don't want to recruit you. And then I was like, okay, cool. And then I played for UCLA, and the first year that I was at Ojai, I played against Raymond Sarmiento, who was kind of my lifelong rival. Rival is a loose term because he was better than I was. He was my lifelong, he owned me for my whole life.
Nemesis. Let's put it that way.
And after the match, I lost to him. And after the match, you know, it was a close match, well fought. And Peter Smith came up to me and said, like, hey, you know, I think I made a mistake by not wanting to recruit you, and I really like you. And, you know, I kind of rebutted that to him and said, you know, I respect you a lot as a coach, and we had a great relationship after that. But at the time in high school, I think it was just kind of a little difference of where we were at, and so it wasn't really ever an option.
That's great. I love that story. That's super cool for sharing that. Thanks. Yep. It feels like right now college tennis in the United States has really become an international circuit, that almost everyone who's playing at all of the campuses, they're all recruiting from everywhere else but the United States. So like at UCLA, I can just think of you and Mackie, who were actually homegrown here in California and actually got onto the team. It seems like it's a very hard thing to do, and yet somehow you did it.
Yeah, so actually during my time, Grant Chen was the director of ops for my first 2 years, the assistant coach for my last 2 years. And he had a huge voice, and shout out to him, because he was one of the most influential people in my career and still a great friend. But he had this vision, as he was, UCLA was before my time, all foreign. I mean, there was like very few players that were not foreign,
right,
for UCLA.
Right.
And then during my time, we had Daniel Kosakowski, Southern California legend, me, Marcos Garon, Mackie's NorCal, but still, you know, guys like Warren Hardy, Alex Brigham, Dennis McCutcheon, you know, so we did actually have quite a few homegrown people. And, you know, kind of to the point that I was mentioning earlier, I think that really brought the camaraderie to the next level. And that made us such a tight team, is because I'm playing with Dennis McCutcheon, Marcos Garon, Alex Brigham, Warren Hardy, all guys that I've grown up playing with since I was eight years old, basically. And I think we had this level of comfort, but also like fierce competitiveness with each other, that we didn't want the other one to one up us. So I wanted to play three. No, but Dennis wanted to play three, but you know, he wasn't going to let me play three because he really wanted it. And again, it was a friendly type of camaraderie. But I think what really made our team successful was the fact that everyone was so competitive, and no one wanted someone else to play above them in the pecking order, or, you know, be seen as a better player. So I think that it was friendly competition, of course, but and sometimes, you know, it got heated, but it was all in good spirit. But I think that one thing was the thing that kept us trying really, really hard in practice and fighting really hard in matches, and ultimately brought us a lot of success.
Yeah, that was great. And you actually reached number one in the NCAA rankings, which is what a feat. That's phenomenal.
Yeah, I still can't believe that. I lost in the first round of the Tulsa All-American, you know, ITA tournament, which was the big start of the year college tournament. Lost in the first round of the main draw, went back to the hotel and was like, oh, that sucked. And somehow after that, won 19 straight matches to become number one in the country. So
19 straight. That's incredible.
It goes to show you, I mean, if you come to work every day, you know, work with tennis, whatever, if you come to work every day with a growth mentality and you try to get better, you never know when your break's going to come. And again, that kind of cycles back to what we were mentioning earlier about just having a good attitude and being knocked down. Cause really you just need one break. I mean, with a company, you just need one break. With tennis, you know, you just, one thing clicks and you go on a 19 match winning streak. If you had, if I had lost that first round at Tulsa and been super dejected and said, oh, my senior year is off to the worst start ever, I just lost in the first round, you know, woe is me. And it kind of just snowballed in a negative direction. I never have that feat. And I think a lot of players would have, that very well could have happened to them.
Wow. And I think you also hold the record for the highest number of wins at UCLA. Is that right?
I don't think so. I think it's up there, but I'm not sure that it's the highest. I had 119 wins. That number haunts me to this day. I could have been 120, man. 119.
Round it up.
Unbelievable.
Still phenomenal to be at that level of tennis and have that many wins against people literally in an international circuit because you're playing from the best from all over the world. You've been in this world. What is the disconnect with college tennis, recreational tennis, and pro? It just feels like it's all in its own world. And, you know, like I used to always watch Matt Lin's father's videos of all the UCLA games, and the level is so high, you know. And yet it just doesn't get the support it needs. I'm sure you have thoughts about that.
When you say support it needs, you're talking just fan engagement, financial. I mean, what exactly do you mean by support it needs?
Yeah, I think, when you look at the level of college tennis players, it just, exponentially high compared to recreational players, and yet recreational players aren't as in awe of college players as they are of pro players. There isn't that kind of seamless chain of growth from, playing league to playing college to playing pro, where they see that connection, even though there is that connection and the level can take you there. It just seems like college has become this, mystery in tennis, where it's not as connected?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, at the same time that I agree with you, I would also say that I've had so many kids come up to me over the years who have been playing in USTA 14s or whatever, and they're like, wow, you're my hero. Like, and that's like very cool to hear, and you're inspiring someone who, has the aspirations to play college tennis one day. So I think within the community, I think that college tennis players are respected. I think that if you were to go to a public park and just get on the court and you were two college players, I think people's heads would turn. They would say, whoa, what's that? These guys are really, really good. And they would watch. So I think there is a level of respect. I think what we're kind of missing in a lot of ways is sort of the marketing approach, the way of getting the word out there that how good these players really are. When there's a USC 25K future and five people are watching the semifinals, I don't think that's indicative of the interest level. I think there's a lot of extremely passionate tennis fans in Los Angeles who, if they knew there was a 25K between two people that were ranked 200 to 400 in the world, I think they would be there. But I think it's really, a lot of the fault lies on the tournament organizers, the press in a way. Like, there needs to be a way of getting this word out there. And kind of tennis has gone up and down with promoters, basically. I mean, When there's someone who is, like Wayne Bryan sort of character, like a Steve Bellamy type character, when there's someone who's just willing to be relentlessly pushy about marketing certain players, you see good things happen. I mean, Grant Chen is another great example. When he brought the LA Tennis Channel, the LA Tennis Challenge, with Novak Djokovic, and there was a couple other great players that year, they did it in Pauley Pavilion. It was a sellout crowd.
I was there.
Yeah, it was a complete sellout crowd. I mean,
yeah.
He is doing the same thing in Dallas with the Dallas Open now. And I think, as painful as it is to say, I really do think that the fault lies on the people that are creating the infrastructure of these tournaments and what's behind them. I think there's a little too much short-sightedness about, I can run this tournament and make $80 an entry. and try to fill it up to 256 people. That's what motivates them. That's what they start thinking about. How can I promote this tournament to get as many entries as possible? Not how can I get as many people here? How can I get as many eyes on these two players or you know this field of players as possible?
Yeah, that's a great point. Thanks for enlightening our listeners on that, because I definitely don't think it's the fault of the players in any way, and I think that there is a tremendous amount of respect when people come out. I used to run a program in Azusa, and we'd have the women's players from Azusa come and practice on our courts, and I invited them to also do some seminars with us. They're always just amazing. You know, the level of play compared to a recreational player, of course, is really, really exciting to watch. And I just wish that in general, like you said, college, ITF, and all of those tournaments would get a lot more love. So I'm right there with you. Yeah. I think that's super awesome. Yeah. Let's talk about your tournament play then after UCLA, which was storied and incredible. Lots of ups and downs, but mostly ups, right?
UCLA, mostly ups. Yeah, I mean, it was an incredible experience. I think the ups and downs really kind of came once I got to the pro level and started to see what that was like and the commitment that it took both from a mental and physical level, but also from a managerial level. I mean, the fact, as you kind of said, you don't lie the blame with the players for there being a lack of audience at a tournament. The players right. are just trying to be the best player that they can be. And that has to take up the entirety of your focus. There's no way that you can manage a successful business at the same time as being a world-class player. I don't think it's really feasible. And that's exactly what being a pro tennis player is. You're trying to be a world-class player while also managing a very, very difficult business.
Yeah, and you are the product. So it's not only that you're managing a business, you're actually managing yourself as the product, which is incredibly hard.
Incredibly hard.
It's hard to separate the personal and the public and how much should you share and all of that. So talk to us. It's so interesting because very few people have had that transition from, you know, playing in college to going into pro. And you mentioned that it was a bit of a struggle. Can you share a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So despite all the success that I had in juniors, college, whatever, when I graduated from college, I was the 2000th player in the world now. So this is, you don't get any accolades for your previous accomplishments. Now you're just starting at a new ladder, new mountain to climb, and you're starting from the bottom, basically. Yeah, you get a few wild cards. I mean, the USTA will invite you to training sessions, but it's not, I mean, that's not really helpful. Yeah, a wild card will be helpful, but it's very few examples. I shouldn't say never. And you know, John Isner is a great example. He got a few wild cards and just rode it all the way to the top. But it's very rare that that happens. You have this whole kind of transition going on, and to hope that you're just going to get one wild card into a tournament and that's going to be your breakthrough, because it has to be. If you win one round, it's helpful, but I mean, you're going to go back into qualies the next tournament. So you have to really like get that wild card in the main draw and win 2 to 3, you know, four rounds to really like make it count. And it's that consistency week after week. You have to be winning and putting yourself in the main draws of tournaments to be competing for those wins. And that's the really difficult part, because in the beginning, when you're in qualies for these things, I mean, you only play 1 to 2 matches a week, and then you have 5 days off and you're not making any money. And it's just a very difficult process to manage on a regular basis. And so for me personally, I left college. I was able to get a wild card into the Newport Beach Hall of Newport, Rhode Island Hall of Fame tournament. I played Steve Johnson on grass, USC rival. That didn't go so well for me. And then it was just kind of a summer of playing challenger qualifying and doing decently well, maybe qualifying, losing first round, maybe getting a round. And it was just kind of a really, you know, tough half of a year. And then so I graduated in summer of 2014, played for 6 months. Now we're in the start of 2015. And I was just kind of thinking, what do I need to be successful here? And I really kind of thought about it from a business perspective. I kind of took my player hat off for a few months, thought about it from a business perspective, put together a business plan for what I thought I would need so that I could fully focus on tennis. That took probably 3 to 4 months to realize. Start of May, let's say, April, May 2015, I had it all in place. Played a full schedule. By that, the end of the year is my Champaign, Illinois video where I got to the semifinals there and had a couple top 100 wins. And so, you know, that, whatever, 7 months there was very successful for me. And I kind of was you know, in a, going in a good direction. Once 2016 came around, I tried to kind of save a few costs, didn't travel with a coach anymore. And it was just, that was one of the toughest parts of my life, because I was going to Israel, Egypt, Korea, South Korea, you know, China, Thailand, like all of these places that I had never ever been before, completely by myself, trying to do it in a fiscally responsible way. And it was just really, really tough. And I think, you know, in retrospect, I think what probably would have made more sense is for me to try to put more effort into kind of creating the business that I created for myself with those prior 6 months in the end of 2015, because that was so successful for me. But because I was felt like I was kind of so close, I was like, maybe I can just keep my player hat on and push through this. And when you're at 400 in the world, the worst thing you want to do is take 3 months off. So that was kind of the realistic.
You gotta keep your momentum
going.
Take,
you know, 2 to 3 months off to like refigure out how I was going to run this business like I did the previous year. And I just didn't really want to lose that. So I kind of pushed through. And I think that was sort of the, you know, the nail in the coffin in a way, because then I played 5 months trying to push through and it was just really, really hard. My performance was down. I think happiness was kind of down and I just wasn't really feeling that great in my game. Came back to the States after a tough summer and was like, okay, I kind of had that epiphany and I was like, okay, I need to treat this the right way. And put together a decent run for a couple months in the US and then was just like, man, this is going to take a lot more than I think I'm willing to give it at this point. And so I just made that decision to move on to the next chapter of my life. And that was a really hard decision. That was a really, really hard decision because of how passionate I am about the game. But I think given where I am right now, I'm quite happy that I did make that decision.
That's great.
And, you know, the ability for me to still play tournaments, still play a lot of tennis, I think is something that's very important to me, because a lot of my colleagues who were successful players, they don't touch a racket now. They like, there's some trauma there. Like there's some like, oh, I don't want to do that. Like it's very, I don't even want to touch that. And for me, I think doing it the way that I did, I can still be very, very involved in tennis and love it. And, you know, kind of accept that I'm not going after that goal of being number one in the world anymore. I'm just kind of playing as a recreational player.
That's great. We need you in tennis. We need people at your caliber to inspire us and to keep us going and, you know, to tell the story also of, you know, what you've experienced, because most of us will just only dream of having a career as storied as yours or wins like you or even a serve like yours. Because I've seen your bombs, man. They're pretty incredible.
Feels good to hit them, that's for sure.
You did a little coaching as well in there with Nicole Gibbs. Can you talk about your desire to coach?
Yeah. So actually, when I stopped playing, I was kind of like, I don't really want to coach. So I didn't for a long time, and I kind of just played for me. And then Nicole asked me, I mean, I've been friends with Nicole. She moved from Ohio to Santa Monica her junior year of high school, or to Manhattan Beach, and then she came to my high school. And it's very tough to be an 11th grader, a new kid 11th grader, let's put it that way. And so, you know, she kind of had a little bit of difficulty assimilating into the crowd, and I think I was kind of like, you know, we got along via tennis, and then I kind of helped her with that, and, you know, we just became really, really great friends. She lives 5 minutes away from me now. So we've been really great friends for a long time. And obviously she went to Stanford. I went to UCLA. We were super close during that whole time. And her dad, who was kind of her manager, coach, whatever figure you want to call him, he was my English teacher and tennis coach at Crossroads for my last 2 years.
Oh, no way.
So traveling with them was super, or, you know, super natural. It was two great friends. We were all really close. And I think the main thing that she wanted me to help her out with, it wasn't so much my coaching. It was more just kind of, she wanted, you know, a friend and someone that was knowledgeable about the game to be able to hit with her and just kind of make her life on tour a little bit more enjoyable in a way.
Which is so important. It's that positive community you're talking about.
It's the most important, I would say. So yeah, we had a great time doing that. I coached her for 2 months on kind of the challenger circuit in the US. And then we went to Australian Open together, which was my first time in Australia, first time at that tournament. And then we did, you know, the Sunshine Swing, Indian Wells, Miami, played in Monterey, Bogota. So I got to kind of see, it was really wholesome for me because this is the level of tennis that I felt like if I kept pushing, you know, I might've had the chance to reach this. And so here I am kind of experiencing it firsthand with one of my best friends. So it was really, really wholesome for me. And I think that after doing that for 5 or 6 months, I was really like, man, I think I made the right decision. Like, I saw all the pain and the troubles that she was going through. And they were so much the same as the pain and troubles that I went through as a pro player. And I was like, you know, as a lower level pro player, which I am, you always look at the top and you just go, if I could just make it to top 100, it'll be roses. And so then to be traveling with someone who is top 100 in the world, who has had Grand Slam wins, who has, you know, gotten very far in WTA tournaments, to be there firsthand with her, and she still has that same insecurity and, you know, pain that, you know, I did as a lower level player. It's like, wow, I mean, this is really, really difficult. So I think perhaps, you know, that changes if you get seated at slams. I think maybe that might be the kind of tipping point where it does sort of become a little bit more roses. But I mean, until you get there, it's just really, really difficult.
Yeah. Well, that's great that you were there for her and also got to travel together. And I'm sure that was a lot of fun and a lot of really cool places.
Yeah, I mean, we had a great time, and again, I'm so thankful for her for giving me that experience because I thought it came at a really good time in my life, and you know, it really kind of helped sate that curiosity that I had, which was, did I make the wrong decision by, you know, giving up the game at this point? You know, do I feel like I had more to give, and do I feel like, you know, I didn't really achieve my potential? And I think after traveling with her and seeing that, and, you know, having the times that we had, I feel like I kind of accomplished that in a way. So again, it sort of helped put a pin on kind of my professional retirement, and yeah, really, really, really enjoyed that.
Yeah. And I wonder if that kind of opened the door for you to start thinking about yourself as a coach, because I know now in your entrepreneurial life, you've launched an app talking about coaching and helping tennis players, and it's called Improve. Can you tell us a little bit about that direction?
Yeah. So I think there is a want to give back. I think just there was something that was kind of weird about coaching to me where I was like, oh, I don't want to do that. But now that I have done it a little bit, I do really enjoy it. I actually volunteer and do a kids clinic at Beverly Hills Tennis Club here in town. And I did that last night, and it's all, you know, 10 to 14-year-olds kind of thing. And so I absolutely cute. Love it. I really, really enjoy it.
I'm sure they love you.
So there is this kind of, you know, I feel like there is knowledge that I gained in, you know, my quest for improvement in tennis. And I do kind of want to share that with the rest of the world. And as far as Improve's concerned, I think my main issue with coaching was, I think coaching is really, really hard if you're out there 7-8 hours a day, which is kind of what a lot of coaches do. I mean, there is a lot of joy in what you're doing, but that just time commitment that you have to give is to be on the court, to be in the sun, to be as engaged as you need to be to actually help someone get better. Because as a coach, I mean, at least as a player for me, I hated it when a coach was like half involved, half engaged. Like, they're on their phone a little bit. They're like, oh, yeah, good shot. And it's like, dude, I'm out here busting my, you know, I'm trying to get so much better. And, like, you are here to help me, and you're going to, like, not be that engaged. And so I think, the part that really kind of sort of steered me away from coaching was just the time commitment that you had to give to it and how difficult it was. And so with Improve, it's really our goal to make coaching personal interactions scalable. And so it's a self-improvement platform that is an open platform for anyone to create an experience on anything. For now, we started with tennis, we started with chess, and we did a prototype with veterans. So the main aspect of the platform is there's different attributes in your schools. So for tennis, those attributes are forehand, focus, strength and endurance, strategy, you know, those types of things. For chess, it's your tactics, it's your openings, it's your end games, it's your mastery of different pieces. For veterans, it's things like financial issues, family relationships, depression, sleeplessness. These are all different attributes that you need to sort of conquer to become proficient in whatever field that you want to be proficient in. And so Improve breaks down those categories by attributes and gives a personalized experience to everyone that joins. So the way that I look at it is, you know, I am not the tennis coach on the platform, Carousel is, but you're basically, by joining Carousel Improve Tennis School, you are getting one-on-one type focus from him without having to pay whatever his hourly rate is. And I think on you know, the coach side, it's very important because, hey, spending 8 hours a day on the court is tough, and I want to be able to help, you know, people all around the world at a rate, you know, in a way that doesn't completely burn me out. So it's scalable for them. It helps, you know, kind of keep them off the court if that's what they want to do. And, you know, they can reach way more people than they would have thought before. And for the player, it helps them feel like they are getting a personal connection without having to pay an absurd rate. So, you know, we're really excited about it right now. We just launched the early access. You know, would love anyone that is interested to check out the website and apply to be a part of it. We're going to launch in May. But for now, we kind of have this early access going, and anyone can apply to be a part of it.
Yeah, that's great. And it's spelled MPROOV. Yeah.
And the website is improveapp.com.
Improveapp.com. Yeah. That's so interesting that you have Karoo training people. Why not yourself? I'm sure that you add to it in your own way, but
yeah, mainly because we're trying to build an open platform, and I just, as a founder, I kind of want to stay as on more of the higher level than, you know, being the actual influencer on the platform. So for, you know, for tennis, we have My Tennis HQ, that's Karoo's platform. For chess, we have Agadmator. And so, you know, for me, I think it's just like, I see myself as more on the high level, kind of trying to help these people create the best learning experiences. And
that's great.
I think it's, in a way, you know, it's very important because I'm using all of the different stuff that I learned from my quest to be the best tennis player that I could, or still can, to create kind of a system to help other people get that message across in sort of a streamlined way.
Yeah.
So I think, and even though I'm not the tennis coach, it's still a lot, you know, of my theories are in there.
Well, I mean, Karoo is great, and his My Tennis HQ on YouTube is a must watch for lots of people. But I'm sure a lot of people would love to connect with you as well and continue to learn from your experience. So it's great that you're doing this app and that you're empowering Karoo to do that. That's really awesome.
Yeah, and again, I mean, the hope is that, you know, we're kind of controlling the launch of the schools right now just to make sure everyone has a good experience. But, you know, the hope is that anyone can create a school on anything that they're proficient in, and it's the best way to monetize that proficiency. You know, you can help as many people as want to be helped by you, and it might be a very, like, Carew's school might be very, you know, mental focused, very ground stroke focused, whatever. Your school might be more how to use tennis to get, you know, a great education and then get a great job. Or it could be, you know, more about serve and volley versus Carew school is more about ground stroking. So we want to kind of give everyone the opportunity to have a unique take and, again, help a scalable amount of people. Because, you know, again, I mean, even with what you do with your coaching, I'm sure that it would give you great happiness if you could help millions of people, or, you know, thousands of people, as opposed to just however many people you do help. And, you know, I'm sure all the people that you do help are very thankful, but I'm sure there's a lot more people in the world that would love to learn from you.
Well, I'd love to learn from you.
Well, I'm here. So
that's one of, I'm here, that's one of the reasons I
download. You can download Improve, but, yeah, and learn from me.
That's right. And Crew. I mean, he plays amazing. I recently saw the match with him and Winston, and he's training Winston now, yeah, and his playing and stuff. And yeah, it's just the level of quality in the ball that he hits is kind of amazing.
Yeah, so you just know Winston too. I'm hoping to play a set against him myself. that's going to be coming soon.
Oh, great. Yeah. That's awesome. Well, just in ending, I know a lot of people are listening and just thinking, well, you know, what can I learn from Improve? And what is one specific thing that you feel like would really help them if they were to download this app and connect as a recreational player?
I think just the platform itself is extremely helpful because it forces you to think about what are my strengths and weaknesses as a player. And this was something that was really important to me. My consistency was not one of my strengths as a player. I remember I had a friend in high school who was like, I don't even want to practice with you because you miss every ball. So,
well, because you're going for winners, yeah,
I
every
mean,
shot.
My style of play, I'm 6'6", I have long hair, I'm loud, I want to hit the ball as hard as I can and make myself appear crazy and wild and hope that you miss the ball. I'm not going to try to rally backhands with you 100 in a row. That's not my style. So just the platform of Improve forces you to say, my consistency is bad, but my power is great. My first serve is really good, but I struggle with my return. And just that kind of system of thinking about what you're good at, what you're bad at, and then giving you an action plan that every single day you can say, oh, well, I struggle with my return. How do I get better at it? Here's one resource. Here's another resource. Here's another resource. And the idea is that we just keep providing you with different resources that will help you improve whatever area of your game you feel like you need to improve.
That's so great. Yeah, it sounds really good. We'll definitely put a link on our show notes so that people can check it out. And I definitely am excited to introduce it to the people that I coach and my little community of players. Super proud of them. And I'd love to talk to you sometime about our nonprofit that we've just launched last year and the funded by the USTA. It's just incredible that we're able to do. Actually, our goal is free lessons for all. So similar to what you're doing.
That's pretty much our goal too. Yeah, I mean, right now the platform is completely free for improvers, which is kind of the person that is improving on the platform. We hope to charge $3 a month to enroll in a school. But then, you know, there's kind of three. We always say this in our pitches: is there's three main ways that we hope the platform can help the world. One is it provides the people that are improving an accessible way to improve at anything that they want to improve at. Whether it's your tennis, your dating, your mental strength, whatever it is, we hope that we provide a way to do that. Number two, we provide a way for anyone with a proficiency, no matter how niche it may be, to monetize that expertise. Maybe you're really, really good at helping kids from third world countries get into, you know, use tennis to get into college and create a career out of it. Maybe that reach is only, you know, 1,000, maybe 2,000 people, but that's the 2,000 people in the world that you're really, really helping. And, you know, you can make a little bit of money for doing that yourself. And then the third way, which is tied to your nonprofit, is we want to give the platform away to all types of charities, nonprofits, that type of thing. So that's what I mentioned. We did a prototype with veterans. So we did that prototype with, you know, many of the biggest veteran organizations in the country. And one of them told us, they were like, this is the platform we've been hoping someone would build for the past 10 years, because wow, they see service members come out of the military and they have so many problems. I mean, you know, it's a very tough life that these people have lived. And some of them need help with their financial issues. Some of them need help with just kind of their mental well-being. And right now they leave the organization, you know, they meet with their person at the organization and they say, hey, work on X, Y, and Z. And then they don't see him again for a year. And it's like, well, what are they supposed to do with that? I mean, this provides a trackable way to kind of interact with your constituent and say, like, hey, we're working on those financial issues. Did you make sure to send in your form? Did you make sure to update your resume? You know, types of things like that. And it's exactly that. It's free lessons. It's accessible lessons for anyone around the world to be able to kind of chase that passion that they have.
That's great. Well, Clay, I love how you're using everything that you are. You're talking about veterans, and I can just tell that comes from your space of coming from a military family and just caring about people who are in that space, and you understand them. You understand the tennis community. You must be a chess player.
Yep. Not a great one, but it's a very strategical improving. Game, which I love. I'm down to play any game as long as there's an element of strategy in it, which tennis definitely falls under that category. Chess falls under that category. I'll say yes to any game.
Well, I love that you're using your passion to impact the world in a positive way, help people to improve, and just love that you could spend an hour with me talking. Thank you so much. I can't wait to share this with the rest of the world. So appreciate your time.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thanks, BK. And yeah, I would love to talk further, or, you know, if you have any sort of events or coaching clinics that you do sort of like FOE, I would love to come over and play with your players and get to meet you in person and any of that. So
absolutely. We'll definitely do that. Well, thank you so much. We'll talk to you soon.
Awesome, PK. Take care.